Ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Linux Lads podcast. I'm your host for this episode. I am Connor.
I'm Mike.
And I'm Shane.
It's been an exciting couple of weeks since we were last on. Let's just get going with the episode. If anyone who was paying attention to our last episode, we now have an Azure VPN coupon code. So if you go to the Azure VPN website, as you're checking out for the 3-month plan, if you click on the add code button and add in Linux Lads when ordering, you get 30% off. Azure VPN offer OpenVPN, and they also offer WireGuard, which is this new hotness in the Linux world, which is part of the reason we kind of reached out to them and asked, could we get a discount code for our podcast? So that is, again, if you go to their 3-month plan and click add code, put in Linux Lads, you get 30% off 3 months. So now going into the discussion, and the first one on the list that I'm going to pick off is LibreOffice have released a new 6.2 release with the new notebook bar. From any videos and renderings I've seen of this, it seems to emulate the ribbon interface from Microsoft Office. Not quite the same, but the same basic idea. It's also not enabled by default. So for the people who don't like change and are going to be all torches and pitchforks around about this and saying, oh, what are they doing with change? And it, you have to go to the menu and change the interface. So it's all they're doing is they're adding a new user interface option onto that list. What are your guys' thoughts on this new notebook interface?
I looked at it briefly, so it used to be there for a while. Oh, it's been there for a while. It was buried in like the menu that said these features are I'm missing a word here. Basically, it was features that were not meant to be tested by the wide audience, just by people who were really interested in it.
Pre-release features or something like that.
Yeah, I'm missing a stupid word. It's somewhere in the show notes anyway. This is really extremely professional, isn't it? Experimental, that's the word. So the notebook bar was there or has been there as an experimental feature. Now they put it into the menu. You, as Connor said, you have to enable it. It's not enabled by default. I've tried it. There are a few variations of it. One of them looks pretty much like the Microsoft Office menu. I use LibreOffice, especially Calc, very often, like daily, and I don't think I'll be switching because I really don't care much what it looks like, and I already have a workflow, so it's not for me, but I think it's extremely beneficial for people who are coming from Microsoft Office because it's going to be familiar to them. So I like the way they did it. I wouldn't be bothered if I had to go and disable it, but I like the way that it's there. I like that it's accessible, and I think this is a positive change altogether.
Yeah, I haven't actually used it myself, but I have looked at a lot of the screenshots, and I do like it because the LibreOffice UI for me was never the prettiest thing ever. Like I haven't ever really liked it. I found the icons and the layout and everything a little bit fugly. So this is quite nice. It's a nice change. It makes it look a bit more sleek, a little bit more modern, which is the important thing. Definitely borrowing a lot from Microsoft Word, but sure, like nobody can deny that many Microsoft Office programs are pretty good and they're kind of worth their salt and they're the kind of office standard in the world. So, or the productivity standard anyway. I like it. I don't know. I've yet to use it properly. So that could change when I actually get down to using it.
To echo some of Shane's points there, yeah, I've basically just judging this off screenshots and videos of them announcing the feature or demonstrating the feature. I've not actually used it myself because I don't think I'm on Ubuntu 18.10 here, and I don't think the official version has been updated to, or the version that comes with Ubuntu has been updated to 6.2 as of yet. So I don't think I've been able to had the opportunity to try this. But when Microsoft came out with the ribbon interface for Microsoft Office. I think it was Office 2007 is according to my recollection, could be wrong. I actually, there was a bit of a learning curve, but once I got used to it, I actually found that I preferred it. So going back to LibreOffice or OpenOffice or whatever it was at the time, and having the old tree-like menus, I actually found them as a step back rather than a step forward. Some people may disagree with me. This is my own subjective opinion. So I'm quite happy that they're cleaning up the interface as well. I find that the old interface before this new notebook interface was very cluttered. I found this kind of streamlines things, especially for people who literally only do about four or five things when they're typing up an office document, or when they're doing a spreadsheet or whatever, whether it's just I'm typing up this thing and all I want to do is change a couple of fonts, or I want to add a couple of images in and that's basically all I want to do, then rather than hunting and pecking through menus, this just puts them up on tabs. So, oh, I want to adjust the font, I'll click on this tab. Oh, I want to add a photo, I'll click on this tab. For those kind of users, which I believe is like 80 to 90% of users who just want to do simple things with their Office suite, this is great because it simplifies the interface. For the people who really want powerful features, you can literally, it's a checkbox. You can go back and say, I don't like this. Or it's not even enabled by default. So it's not like you have to disable anything. You just stick with the way it is at the moment. And if you want, you can go into the interface and select it. And as soon as 6.2 comes out for 18.04, or when I see it appearing, I will be switching to it and seeing if I like it. May report back that I absolutely hate it, but it does seem like a good change for me.
Yeah, well, if you had Arch like yours truly, you'd be already on it, of course. It's there. It's not just 6.2, it's 6.2.0.3, I think. So, like, well ahead of you.
I do have Antergos on my laptop, just saying.
Yeah, you'll be seeing it soon, though, then. Oh, you probably already have it.
You've been out-arched.
Oh, no, he didn't. Mm-hmm. Anyone else want to pick one of the topics?
Oh, there was an interesting news that I don't know about you guys, but I've not expected this. The Raspberry Pi Foundation opened a store in Cambridge in the UK, still in Europe, that looks a bit like the Apple Store. And that was something that came for me out of the blue. And I first thought, what the hell are they doing? And then I thought, oh, hold on a second. This is a very good idea, because in my retail experience, I actually sold quite a few Raspberry Pis in a shop, and it was most of them were to people who came with their kids, so the parents and children, and they like it's hard to explain it to a parent, like, what can you do with this. And if you have it already set up, I've never been to the store, and I assume that they'd be having things on display, it can help extremely for not only the children to see what it does, but also for the parents who obviously are paying for it. And the fact that it's going to look like an Apple Store, or basically in the way that it's going to be very slick and it's going to be very professional, and that can only like make the experience of the Raspberry Pi better. And I just hope that one day maybe they'll open one in Dublin. Also, the people were quite skeptical, like, does it make sense in this day and age to open a physical store? But this is not just a shop to me. This is more akin to like Games Workshop. You know, guys, they have got their games, you can buy them, but you can also go there, or kids can go there and build the whatever you call those things that they play with, right? They can construct the battle scenes. Yeah, that kind of thing. I've never been into it, but, you know, kids go there and paint the figurines and everything, right? So, that brand and that company is thriving. So I think if they pull off something like this as well with Raspberry Pi, it can only be a good thing.
Yeah, just when you mentioned Games Workshop there, I used to be actually a hardcore Warhammer 40k guy. I have a big box on top of my wardrobe with just boxes of Space Marines and shit like that. Yeah, so OG nerd. But I recently noticed they've actually rebranded to just Warhammer. They've dropped the whole Games Workshop thing. But anyway, that's a side chapter there. Yeah, I agree with you. It's not so much just a place to sell Raspberry Pis. It's a place to promote the whole ecosystem and the whole brand, and to, you know, have a physical place where parents and kids can go and then they can see it in action and they can get everything they need right then and there without having to order it online. It's a good idea for me. I like it. And I think they should open more of them. Whether it makes money or not is not the point, because Raspberry Pi is a foundation, and like a charitable foundation. So, you know, the profit-making aspects and how many pies they're going to sell isn't really relevant there. So, yeah, I agree with you.
They still have to make enough money not to go bust, but, yeah, in principle.
I am, yeah, the whole thing of this, of just going in, being in there and educating people, having kids coming in with their parents, is a very good idea. I mean, I think there was a blog that they posted, and they've a lot of photographs of the front of the store with their logo on the front and the various tables and their setup and everything. And I mean, for people who are familiar with the Raspberry Pi, this may seem obvious, but from the photos, for moms or dads or whatever, as they're coming in with their kid and they're not that familiar with the Raspberry Pi, I just noticed that it's possibly a revelation of the whole thing, of because they have pies and they're just hooked up to monitors. And I'm sure people who are used to desktops and towers are going to go, okay, yeah, that's fine, that's the monitor, but where's the computer? And then what? They're like, no, the computer is that board with all the wires sticking out of it, that's literally just sticking in front of the monitor. And they're like, wait, what? Yeah, is that whole thing of, it is very educational to see it in person, just to say, this little thing, this is basically the 2D dimensions of a credit card. I mean, it's a bit thicker with all the components on top of it, but it's like the width and the height of it are pretty much like credit card size. I say, this credit card size thing is powering this monitor, and you're able to open up a web browser and go to whatever you want. You're able to go to Twitter or whatever you want to do. And you can also do coding on it as well. So it's also an educational tool. To see it physically, I think, is a very good selling point.
Well, if it was only a computer, that would be one thing. But of course, like, the main educational thing about the Raspberry Pi is physical computing. So you can plug a lot of things into it. You can create circuits. You can basically build whatever, as far as your materials, imaginations, and the laws of physics allow you to go. So for that purpose, like, to sell a small computer is not as difficult, but to explain to the parents that yes, you can definitely take a bunch of wires and a shield and a board, and to show it to them how it all goes together, I think that's priceless.
Plus, I've been looking at the photos while you guys were talking there, and the store looks nice. Like, it looks very classy.
Yeah, Apple-esque.
Yeah, I think it has just enough to set it apart, though. It doesn't look quite as polished as an Apple store, but it still looks really tasteful and it looks really kind of modern. I really like the way they've done it, like with the you know, the black sign and the white lettering and everything. It's very cool.
Yeah, it does look good. So I think in other news, Fedora are designing a new logo. I think the primary motivation behind this is they're saying that at the moment their logo is not monochrome, so it can't really be translated to a monochrome logo is very useful, because you can stick it on a t-shirt, or you can do whatever, or even, let's say, if they're printing off in grayscale or whatever they're, to have the logo still recognizable. It's very useful to have a monochrome logo. So they have a few proposed designs. And I think the is it the designer, Mike, you were saying, is actually Irish from the look of things. So, yay, Irish coders.
And the design team, the federal design team lead, I think she's Irish. Her name is Maureen, and she has a blog post that where she puts the where she reports on the progress of the design process, and it's quite interesting read as well.
So there's your Irish plug right there. So yay, champion the Irish people. Good on you, Maureen. But getting back on topic, I'm looking down through some of the proposed designs, and some of them were actually look pretty cool. I haven't yet decided whether I like. If you go, it'll be in the show notes. But there's candidate one, there's candidate two, and some of them I kind of they are very similar. There's a kind of a subtle difference between the two, but I think I'm kind of slightly leaning towards candidate one at the moment. But I could change my mind in a second. Because they are very similar.
I think the candidate two has been dropped now. If you scroll a little bit down, and they are now elaborating on candidate one. So they split. I think they split at least as of the last blog post. They split candidate one into three different candidates that to me are like almost identical.
It's very subtle differences between the two. As you're scrolling down, it's kind of we kind of like this design of the font for the E and this design for the A, and what you think between these. It's very subtle. So they're going down into refinement of the logo, which I suppose is a good thing, which means they've kind of settled on the broad strokes of the logo.
It looks like it's in professional hands, so they and that's a good thing. So they kind of painstakingly judge which way a little bit of a letter goes. So I can see that it's in a good hands in Fedora. Whatever they choose, they are going to end up with a good logo.
Yeah, I've been reading through Maureen's blog here, and it's very interesting. She uses like 100% open source tools to do all her design. Doesn't use any Apple or Adobe suites. So yay. Go fast.
Yeah, there's another not so nice aspect to it. I've scrolled down to the end, and at the end she's asking for feedback, obviously. But then she says that she's disabled the comments on the blog because she's about just, and I'm going to quote this, "I've just about reached my limit of incoming thoughtlessness and cruelty. If you have productive and respectful feedback to share, I am very interested in hearing it still. I don't think I'm too hard to get in touch with, so please do." I don't know what she was referring to because I didn't see any untoward feedback in there. It's probably got deleted. But like, why should people be jerks about stuff like this? I can probably imagine what was happening there. Maybe like I don't understand why would somebody choose this particular platform to express and voice the inner jerk they possess.
Some people just use the internet as a kind of an echo chamber of they don't perceive any negative remarks. I mean, obviously, if you are that kind of a jerk to somebody in real life, you'll see that they'll either get angry and possibly, depending on the comment, would possibly, I don't know, invoke violence towards you if it's something very severe, or you'll see that they're visibly upset if that's their reaction. Whereas on the internet, all you're doing is there's a comment box and you send off the comment, and it's you don't see the immediate impact of that comment.
No. I get that in front underneath some stupid Ku Klux Klan video on YouTube, but here is something very constructive happening. People are actually getting together to produce something important.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm just saying that jerks will be jerks. Is what I'm saying, regardless of what the topic is. It's really unfortunate that it's happening on something so positive as a logo redesign. And from the looks of things, it's they're the the what they're settling on looks to be very professionally designed. It looks like it's a very well designed logo. All they're doing is, as we're saying, is just refining it and saying maybe this font for the E or this font for the A looks better or whatever. But they essentially have settled down on their broad logo, and from the looks of things, it looks very well designed. So kudos to them. It's just it's unfortunate that she does feel that she has to disable the comments below because she was receiving so much negative feedback. I mean, there's better ways to express it than in the comments section. If you do feel that negatively about it, then I would say don't really voice it in the comments below the article. I mean, if you feel that strongly about it, then you're probably trying to contact Fedora directly or something.
Yeah, if you feel that strongly about a logo and people designing a fucking logo, like, just lock yourself in a room and shut the fuck up.
So the next bit of news is there's a new version of Plasma is out. So Bluetooth devices now show their battery usage. And Firefox 64 can now optionally use a native KDE open and save dialogues, and there's also improvements to Discover, which anytime I've used Discover, I've found it not to be the most intuitive thing in the world. So it's fine, but there are better tools out there. So any improvements to Discover is only a good thing. I've gone so far as installing GNOME software on a KDE install, because GNOME software for me was just far superior to be able to install software than KDE Discover. But any improvements to Discover is always a good thing.
Yeah, I'm still very much on the fence between GNOME and KDE, because I know I want to switch from Cinnamon and Mint. I just for the sake of something new, I guess. Plus, I've had some annoyances with Mint that, you know, I'm not really in the mood to troubleshoot. So I think a refresh is in order.
If you're into that much of a change, I will take a leaf out of the OpenSUSE challenge, where I was introducing a lot of people to KDE Plasma, and it was Jason Evangelo was the guy who's doing the challenge, and he said it was his very first time doing anything in KDE. So if you're used to GTK apps, I would probably advise you to maybe not go from Cinnamon to just stock GNOME. Maybe go to something that's maybe KDE Neon or Kubuntu or something like that, because KDE Plasma is actually quite good, quite interesting.
But if you are like, if you do like the Mac a little, I can't even talk today. If you like the Mac kind of interface, then GNOME might be a bit more suitable. From, you know, I think it's a case of trying many things and then just sticking to one. I was there, Connor, for a moment thinking that you are recommending Shane to just leap into OpenSUSE.
I would never recommend anyone does that, as I have partaken in the challenge, and about a week into the challenge, I sent Jason a message saying, so how long is this challenge? And he said 2 weeks. And after that, I think he's changed it to, actually, I want to live in this for a while, so I'm changing the challenge to a month. I went, nope. And I just wiped it. So our next topic is Linux ever going to be useful for an average non-technical user? Is it ready now? Should an average non-technical user even try? And I think Jason Evangelo is writing an article about gaming without Windows, and maybe an average non-technical user should be able to switch. So I think this is our big topic for this episode. So I have some thoughts on this, but I'm going to hear your guys' thoughts first. So
just to specify, he wrote an article on his Forbes page about how gaming without Windows is still not there because it's not intuitive enough, especially in regards to installing NVIDIA drivers. And that gave me all this idea, should Linux even try to be for the average non-technical user? Just to start it off, I think that computers as they are, and that includes Macs, Windows, Linux, and Android phones, are not suitable as community devices. Like, the average non-technical user should get like a non-technical appliance, like a TV, a fridge, an Xbox, and just pushing it. And if they need it for work, like, say, a receptionist or something like that, they shouldn't deal with Windows or Linux or even Android. They should have something that is basically just limited as an appliance to what they need to do, not
a thin client or a dumb terminal.
Not even that. Just something that abstracts away the operating system. And if you need two buttons, then to give you just the two buttons, you know, like, so for example, if you want to run your games on any platform, you need to install drivers. So you need to know what drivers are. I think if you just want to play games, why should you even know this? Like, you should get a box that you download your games to from your store, and you connect the controllers and you play the game, right? I don't think people who are not interested or who don't need the whole power of the operating system should be exposed to it. And this is not, by the way, I sound really arrogant saying this, but this is not a knock on their intelligence. When I say receptionist, I don't mean that the people are not intelligent enough to operate a computer. I think that, and it's like the uptake in Facebook, for example, proves to me that people, if motivated, can navigate a completely bonkers application with the skill of a hacker with 50 years of experience, right? But they should not need such motivation to operate a tool, which for most of them, computers have become. And it's insane to me that we actually give them this massive powerhouse with so many options and expect them to just use it as for the one task they need to do.
I have we've all introduced at least one person into Linux, I guess. Anyone I've introduced Linux to, it's always been a fairly seamless experience in my mind. If like you said, if all you want to do is just browse the web or do something very everyday, then it is possible, I think. But in terms of gaming, I don't know. I think it is quite easy as well. So, yeah, you're right, though. You shouldn't expect the average user to need to know all these things in order to just use Linux or use their computer.
I think this is a much broader topic than just Linux. I mean, if somebody goes out and purchases, I don't know, a Dell or a HP PC and says, I'm buying this because for the purposes of gaming, and let's just say I'm sure if it comes with a graphics card, I'm sure it will come with the drivers inbuilt into it from HP because it's all packaged. But let's say if there's a driver update or whatever, and there's a prompt coming up saying you should install this driver update, and for somebody who's completely non-technical, they're like, yeah, fine, whatever, just click. For me, any time that I've been using Ubuntu, it has been that easy once it's installed. They may not realize that if they have an NVIDIA card, that they do require extra. I mean, it'll still work. It'll still do all the functions that they want to do, whether it's web browsing or whatever, with the free driver. But if they want extra frames per second out of their game, they probably would need the proprietary driver. And after a couple of clicks around in the operating system, it's pretty easy to install that. But would they know that they have to do that? Probably not. So I think that was the whole idea behind the SteamOS, was taking the Linux platform and putting a very simple, the Steam big picture mode, if anyone's ever used Steam, which is very simple. You can navigate it with a controller, and it's just literally just saying, it's just your game art and saying, oh yeah, I want to play that, and then click play and then off to the races. That's what Steam OS essentially was trying to turn any Steam or any Linux box into, was essentially a games console, because that's when you're talking about the Xbox or a PlayStation, that's essentially what it is you buy this thing, it's very simple, you plug in controllers, and if there's an update, a big pop-up will come up on the screen saying there's an update, click yes if you want to do the update, or no later, or whatever. Or, and if there's no update, it's like, I just want to play my game, and then just navigate the big icons and say, yep, I want to play that game. So that's where SteamOS was coming in. I think this is just a general point in relation to desktop grade operating systems versus consoles or simple computing devices. I don't think it's particularly, specific to Linux, but what do you guys think?
Well, I think that this is where Linux can become, well, where the strength of Linux could be kind of discovered, because you can hide it. So it's impossible for Steam to basically create something like SteamOS using Microsoft Windows because of licensing issues and all that legal commercial stuff. But is future, or could future of Linux be in this appliance world where you want a games console? Okay, you get Linux, but with the big picture mode of SteamOS slapped on top of it. You want a TV? Okay, there you go. It's Kodi, but it runs on Linux, but you don't even know that. Do you want a smart fridge? Okay, again, Linux, but it has got only the interface that fridge can be. So, I think that Linux has got that Linux is the only operating system at the moment that is capable of producing that is capable to become a base of all of these appliances, and that people might not even have a computer anymore, but they might have all these connected devices, and that all of them are going to be Linux. And that's probably basically what I'm thinking. Is it a good thing, this possible making computers into appliances? I think it is. Do you guys think that regular users should be exposed to an operating system in its full power?
They should certainly have the choice, though. There should be, all options should always be available. But I think we mentioned this a long time ago, maybe back in season one, like, if they want to go beyond kind of the normal, you know, surface user features, user-friendly kind of interfaces, clicky buttons, friendly things, if they want to go below that and do more, they should have the option. But yeah, by default, they shouldn't be expected to do that.
I would agree of somewhere in the settings. I mean, if you're an intermediate to advanced user and you're thinking, this simple interface is driving me mental because I wanted to do more, let's say, to take your example, a receptionist or a professional writer or something like that who's using their computer as a tool. Again, this is not a slight against, as Mike was saying, not a slight against their capabilities or their intelligence level or whatever. It's their focus. Their focus is on their job, whether it's a receptionist answering emails or answering phone calls, or a writer whose focus is writing their novel or writing their newspaper article or whatever, and all they want to do is the computer is a tool. Yep, show me the word processor, and I want to get to my word processor as fast as possible without being distracted by anything. Then that is the functionality of the computer for that person. But if somebody is a coder or something like that, and they want to tinker with it, or if they're saying this simple UI is driving me mental because I don't like the look of it, or I want to team it up or whatever, then there should be something in the settings and say advanced, and then when you go into advanced, there's a toggle saying beyond this point there be dragons, proceed with caution or whatever. And once you toggle that, then the more advanced view of the operating system would be exposed. I mean, it was the whole thing of, I'm just picking Windows XP because it's the thing that comes into my mind immediately, was the control panel on Windows XP was just an absolute maze of different options. Windows have since refined that of, when you go into your control panel on your version of Windows, it literally is just, click here. Oh, you want to, adjust your mouse sensitivity or something. So just click on mouse and there's a slider that says mouse sensitivity and you're done. But below that, there will always be, do you want more options? And I think that's a good approach to take.
Interesting thing is that we always keep saying, yeah, the more advanced features and options should there be, should be there for a more advanced user. And we've seen is recently on our chat that we have very young and inexperienced users logging in and asking very interesting but advanced questions. Now, my question is, should it be? So if you have somebody who's only interested in a computer from because it does one thing that they need to do, then obviously the other things can be hidden. But if you have somebody who's interested in learning about computers, shouldn't they be thrown at the deep end and just, you know, because that's not your regular non-technical user. This is somebody who might not have any experience, might not be able to get out of Vim, but shouldn't they be just thrown in there and just, you know, forget about like cuddling them into with interfaces that are not showing them the full power? Shouldn't they be thrown at the deep end and say, well, you want to learn how this works, so put in the work. And just, you know, get yourself acquainted with the system. And if you can't fix it, you probably shouldn't be using it.
I can kind of get where you're coming from, but I'm just going to exaggerate your point for effect. I don't think somebody who's brand new to Linux and is curious about Linux, and we should say, yep, Linux from scratch is for you. There is shades of subtlety here. For the masses, Ubuntu or something that's very user friendly is probably the best thing to do. And because it's everything is on a bell curve. I mean, for the vast majority, Ubuntu is catering for it's the peak of the bell curve. It's ignoring the outliers on either side of. Well, some might argue that it's leaning more towards the brand new user, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it's also accommodating the average Linux user as they perceive it as well. So you can do pretty powerful things. You can be a professional coder on Ubuntu. You can do everything pretty powerful things on Ubuntu. What some criticisms is that for maybe more tinkerers and things like that who want to do everything from scratch and they want to change absolutely everything in not just the theme or something. I mean, by changing the entire interface and altogether, like going from Ubuntu, which is stock with GNOME, to changing it to i3 or some other window manager. And people who have that knowledge are able to do that on Ubuntu. So it's a good general platform. But I wouldn't necessarily advocate saying, here's this really difficult thing. You're new to Linux. I'm going to show you the really difficult thing and just throw you in at the deep end.
This is the thing. You see, I kind of learned Linux this way. There was no one around me using it, right? So I would install Ubuntu, use it, played with it, broke it. If I could fix it, fine. If I couldn't, reinstall, and again, and again, and again. And I got gradually better. And I think that's a valid learning curve, you know, rather than telling somebody, okay, you're new, you start on elementary. Once you get used to it, you can go to Ubuntu, and then you can go to Mint, and then you can go to blah, 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 and eventually end up making it from scratch. I think it's not necessarily a good idea to say this is good for the new user. This is definitely good for some segment of the new users. There are people who are using Linux who just want the elementary experience, and they will forever stick with it, and it's going to be good for them. But we should also recognize that some people like to learn from the difficult. You know, there are people, and there are actually schools of like teaching who start teaching you computers by learning you C rather than telling you this is a keyboard, this is a mouse.
I also had a similar experience when I was with Ubuntu. Was I want to do this? I wonder if this works, and could have possibly been that I broke it, and it was the case of I will look in the forums, so look in the help forums, and if they're able to solve it with a command or whatever. But for me, it was there was nothing. Everything was disposable about it, so I could, as an option, always go back and just wipe it and start again. That was my learning process. But for having conversations with people, not everyone is like that. And conversely, there's, as you're mentioning in the chat, there's people who are brand new to Linux and are asking very basic questions. And literally a week later is, okay, how do I install Arch? I was like, oh, whoa. For me, that seemed to be taking a large leap, but maybe they're well capable of taking that leap. But that's that one individual. I think Ubuntu is going after, as I said, the majority of the bell curve rather than focusing on the outliers, either the more advanced users or the really new users. As I said, I know I'm repeating myself, but some would say they are catering more towards the new user. That's right, they are, but they're also not ignoring the middle ground of the majority of the users. Also,
don't think we why Ubuntu specifically. I don't think we kind of mentioned. You know, it's not just Ubuntu. No, they are going by the people who use them most, as you said. I'm more thinking. Say it is generally whenever you listen to podcasts and read about Linux and watch YouTube video, it's pretty much obvious that the general consensus is some distros, and I don't think Ubuntu is necessarily it or isn't, right? But some distros are for beginners, some distros and desktop environments are for people who are more acquainted. And I'm thinking that maybe this idea, or like basically stating this idea as a fact, is as hurtful or and as like as it is helpful. Because, you know, as I said, not everybody is the same. So maybe we shouldn't say these are a beginner's distros, because they are not. Like, there are people with a lot of experience who wouldn't be able to sit down with elementary, or and people with no experience who wouldn't be able to sit down with elementary and use it just because it's not their style, right? There are people who would start with Linux from the command line and never even touch a GUI, because that's how they want to experience computers, and it's their way of interacting with them. So maybe I'm thinking boxing up, like saying Ubuntu is for these kind of people and elementary for these, and OpenSUSE, no one should be using this. That, you know, that's that was a bad joke anyway. But I think that's a bad idea.
So now we will move on to the boner sections quite real quick. So, Mike, you have a boner?
Yeah, I recently discovered a library for Python. It's called Tabulate. Link's going to be in the show notes, and fuck me, it's good. It's basically, if you want to print something into the command line from a Python script and the data is tabular, you have got this little utility that prints it for you very nicely, so you can have printed it with like in a fancy grid, or it outputs it in a format that you can copy and paste into Jira or into Markdown or into, you know, other platforms, and it's formatted for that specific platform, and it's basically amazing. The website for it looks a bit janky and not nice, but the product itself, or the library itself, is amazing.
Yeah, my boner is the latest version of Blender. I recently got this, and it's a big improvement on the UI on previous versions, because I've been struggling with Blender for many years, and this one just, there are several improvements that just work. They're quite subtle, but they're, you know, there's just some menus have been simplified, and, you know, the overall experience is slightly less scary. And I was able to just pick it up and use it. And I was, you know, I was trying to make something in Blender, and, you know, it was quite a good experience. I really like the latest version. So much I don't know about it, and I'm still learning. I'm still most definitely a novice, but the Blender quest continues.
My boner for this episode is actually Lineage OS, because I have been fecking around with various mobile devices, including one that I have Sailfish OS on, but that's for a topic for a point, possibly for another episode. So, but for Lineage OS, is for anyone who's familiar with CyanogenMod, which is the OG custom ROM. I think it was one of the first, if not the very first, Android custom ROM that came out there. Lineage OS is the spiritual successor and continuation of the CyanogenMod project. So it's just taking stock, Android and doing their own custom tweaks, niceties here and there. And it's actually really good. And it's also a way of upgrading your phone is a mobile computer. Upgrading your phone, if your phone has been abandoned by the manufacturer in terms of Android updates, if your phone is saying, oh, you can only get up to Android 7 or you can only get up to Android 8 because and you're clicking on the updates and there are no updates, it could be the case of somebody has done a port of the latest version of Lineage OS for your phone, and it will be maintained with all the latest security patches and all the latest. And even if all you want is just new features, and the fact that it's, you're getting the latest security patches is just a bonus, I highly commend the guys in Lineage OS for resurrecting old devices and maintaining the support for old devices. There are official ports which you can get on their website, but if you go to XDA developers, there's a lot of unofficial ports. I mean, my phone is the essential phone and it's not officially supported by the guys in Lineage OS, but if you go on XDA forums, there's a guy who's ported it over, and I'm running it now on my phone and it's running pretty well. So my boner for this episode is Lineage OS. So one event that I think is worthwhile to point out is the Global Diversity Day is swinging its way around to Dublin on the 2nd of March. It's seems to be for a couple of hours. It's from 11:30 to 2:30 on the 2nd of March. Lulz, just looking down through the website here, there does seem to be some really interesting speakers, and I think it's a worthwhile thing to check out. The tickets appear to be free, just from looking at the website. There's a button to book your free ticket. I do not know if spaces are limited, or if you don't have a free ticket, you won't be able to gain access, but their contact details are on their website. They have Twitter and whatnot. So if you want to ask those kind of questions, I'm sure they will be able to accommodate those queries for you. So yeah, once again, it's in a very worthwhile event is coming up on the 2nd of March, which is the Global Diversity Day. And I think that is coming towards the end of this podcast. So I will let you guys know where you can contact us. So we are on Telegram, which is linuxlads.com/telegram. We're also on Twitter at linuxlads. I believe Linux Labs and Mastodon. And if you forget any of these, they will all be clickable links in the show notes, so you can just click on them. Our email address is show@linuxlads.com. If you have any kind of feedback, positive or negative, we do take constructive criticism. Feel free to email us on show@linuxlads.com. And we do appear in person. And that link will also be in the show notes. So I think we'll wrap things up. Thank you for listening. And I have been Connor.
I've been Mike.
And I've been Shane.